Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the SEC's approval of a rule to have American public companies regularly reveal the gap between what they pay their chief executives and the pay of their employees. Sarah Anderson, who directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and is the lead author of 20 annual executive excess reports, joins us to discuss how, in spite of relentless lobbying from corporate America, this provision from the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act has finally succeeded and will begin to shed light on the growing income gap in America, where 50 years ago a CEO was paid 20 times as much as his employees, compared to today where the gap in CEO pay is 300 times as much as what the average employee is paid. Then we'll hear from the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, Senator Bernie Sanders, who is running for President of the United States as a Democrat. We'll discuss the fate of the P5+1 deal with Iran that President Obama defended today in a passionate speech at American University, and reflect on tomorrow's 50th anniversary of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that has been undermined by the Supreme Court, allowing Republican legislatures to suppress the votes of minorities, as well as getting an update on how the Sanders campaign is doing now that he is in a statistical tie with Hillary Clinton in the latest New Hampshire poll. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of why the Iranians went along with the P5+1 deal and why Israel alone is the only country in the world opposed to it. Abbas Milani, the director of Iranian studies at Stanford University, who taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science and was also on the board of the University's Center for International Relations, joins us. We will discuss the forces inside Iran who are chafing under the unpopular and repressive theocratic government and how American business will be left in the dust if the Congress kills the deal. And joining us now is Sarah Anderson, who directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Sarah is lead author of 20 annual executive excess reports and serves on the Investment Subcommittee of the U.S. State Department's Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy. She is a co-author of the Institute's 20th anniversary executive excess report, Bailed Out, Booted, and Busted, and her books include Field Guide to the Global Economy and Alternatives to Economic Globalization. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Anderson.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And the SEC, after a long delay and a lot of lobbying from corporate America, managed to pass a new rule, which is actually a part of it stems from the 2010 Dodd-Frank overhaul of our financial regulations following the 2008 crash. And this rule basically says that requiring public companies of $1 billion or more to reveal the gap between what they pay their CEOs and the median pay of the rest of their employees. And it'll go into effect, I believe, in 2018 or 2017. And I guess, are they going to keep fighting it? But they've been fighting the Dodd-Frank thing from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Huh?
I am afraid the corporate lobby groups that have been successfully delaying this rule for the past 5 years will not give up, even though today in a historic vote, the SEC voted 3-2 to finalize this rule. These corporate lobby groups, I'm sure, have more tricks up their sleeve. They're going to file lawsuits over this. They'll still try to get Republicans to repeal this new CEO to worker pay disclosure rule altogether. I'm sure the fight is not over, but I have to say, seeing them lose today after 5 years of trying to fight this thing, it's not every day you see that the Business Roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce, all the corporate lobby groups opposed to this, but regulators nevertheless standing up and passing it.
So what is as far as I can tell, their main argument is that this is not really helping the shareholders, which they argue is the SEC's job. And so why wouldn't it be useful to the shareholders of corporations to know how much compensation the CEOs are getting and how it compares to the average worker in the company?
Our argument is that it should be of extreme interest to shareholders. There's a lot of research that's been done that shows that if you have narrower gaps between what the boss makes and what your average workers make, it tends to contribute to greater team spirit, lower turnover among your workers, higher morale, higher productivity. And so just from a very narrow business perspective, this rule should be good news for investors. Beyond that, of course, what we're getting at here are the extreme levels of inequality in this country, with big company average CEO pay several hundred times the pay of their average workers. And so this will do a lot, we think, to draw increased attention to this problem and hopefully lead to further reforms that will have real teeth. You can build on this disclosure by incorporating the CEO to worker pay ratio into tax policy. So to tell companies they'll pay a higher state corporate tax rate, for example, if they have a wider gap. You can also incorporate it into contracting and give preferential treatment to companies that have narrow gaps. So today was a historic victory on disclosure, but I think there's much more to come.
So would the argument, though, that 50 years ago, back in the 1960s, chief executives were paid roughly 20 times as much as their employees, and today it's risen to nearly 300 times as much. And we also, I think, as a society, are aware of the growing inequality and income gaps and the fact that wages have been largely flat since the 1970s. What kind of universe are the CEOs, the Chamber of Commerce, and the lobbyists in? Don't they recognize what's happening in America?
I don't think so. A lot of these people live in a bubble and are pretty disconnected. But there's absolutely not one shred of evidence that the reason why CEO pay has skyrocketed in the past two or three decades is because those top executives are just that much more talented, efficient, effective. There's just no evidence behind that. The pay has ballooned because corporate boards are often made up of executives from other companies who enjoy their fat paychecks, and it's an I scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of situation. And it has nothing to do with company effectiveness. So we're hoping that this will draw attention again to the runaway CEO pay system and also give people a real lever that they can do something with. We could also imagine having consumer campaigns where you label products with what that company's CEO to worker pay ratio is. People might want to know that when deciding what products they would like to buy. So it's really the beginning, I think, of a way to build on so much momentum we've seen in this country around bringing up living wages to also address the problem of income and wealth concentration at the top. We need to narrow these gaps.
But the rules themselves, though, are not without criticism from some unions, in fact, arguing that the new SEC rules give companies too much flexibility in calculating the pay gap. And that, they argue, is a result of this intense, relentless lobbying of the SEC from corporate America. So is there a loophole? How do they calculate the pay gap? And what kind of flexibility do they have?
Right.
Because that would make it meaningless if they could write their own ticket.
Exactly. I think most people who have been following this closely feel pretty satisfied with what the SEC voted on today. The major flexibility that they're offering is in calculating median worker pay. Companies do not have to line up every single wage figure of every employee in their company. They can use statistical sampling to do that. And you know, we'll have to keep an eye on that and make sure that companies are doing it properly. But we think allowing that is one reason why this was able to finally get concluded. Also, companies will be able to exclude up to 5% of their foreign workers from that calculation. Again, it's too bad because the law said all employees were supposed to be included, but this will not have a big impact on that median figure. So I think at the end of the day, despite all the pressure from corporations that were saying, you know, don't do this at all, and even if you do it, completely exclude foreign workers, completely exclude part-time workers, you know, they were trying to just gut it and water it down every way possible. But at the end of the day, I think we wound up with quite a strong rule.
Well, the lobbying group for corporate America, the Center for Executive Compensation, They're arguing that only a small segment of shareholders, primarily unions, certain pension funds and social activists, are likely to use the pay ratio to drive their own narrowly tailored agenda. So they're trying to argue that everybody is perfectly happy. The shareholders are happy to see their CEOs compensated handsomely, no matter what their performance is. So my understanding is that some of these big pension funds, like CalPERS here in California, have a huge position in the market and are significant. So where does that sort of mentality come from, the idea that they're trying to shame companies into paying their chief executives less?
Well, there's a common argument out there that, well, if shareholders don't like it, they can just walk away and they can go to other companies that have different pay practices. And there are a number of ways to respond to that. One is that, you know, big institutional investors like CalPERS are often, you know, invested in index funds. It's hard to just walk away. There are also very high barriers to trying to get shareholder resolutions related to executive pay or other issues passed, because there's a lot of insider control of the voting power. So there are really a lot of obstacles to seeing shareholders as really the solution to this problem. I support having what's called the say on pay rule that also came out of Dodd-Frank, which gives shareholders the right to a non-binding vote every year on CEO pay, but it hasn't had much effect on the actual impact levels of compensation. I think what this rule will do is go beyond the shareholder realm to give broader swaths of the public a real handle for dealing with executive pay. And I think that's really important. We saw with the financial crisis that our executive pay system is not just a shareholder issue. It encouraged the reckless behavior that crashed the economy and destroyed millions of people's homes and livelihoods. And so there's a role for public policy here. There's ordinary Americans should have a vote in this whole debate. And I think having this information of the gaps between CEO and worker pay will be a tool that we can use to make sure that taxpayers are not subsidizing excessive pay, not subsidizing companies that are contributing to the extreme inequality in this country.
But in terms of a possible loophole, my understanding is that companies are allowed to exclude some of their overseas workers from the median pay of their workers. And we know that a lot of big corporations have been outsourcing. So if you're paying your workers in Bangladesh next to nothing, that's obviously going to affect the median. So
yeah, but the loophole is only for a de minimis number of non-U.S. workers and no more than 5% of those foreign workers. And especially, not to become too much of a math geek here, but if they're using statistical sampling, being able to exclude that up to 5% of their workers isn't going to have a huge impact on the number. The other thing that I would say is that if companies are really concerned because they have a lot of foreign workers that might make their pay gap look really high, there's nothing in the rule that would prevent them from providing more information. They could break down their ratio and say, here's our ratio with our U.S. workers, here's what it is globally, here's what it is with different countries. So, I'm not very sympathetic when I keep hearing from the corporate lobby side that, they shouldn't have had to report on the foreign workers. I think the SEC offered them a little bit of a crumb with this up to 5% thing, but it's really not going to have that much of an impact on the median number.
Well, as far as I know, they're not required to even justify why they ship American jobs abroad. I mean, you know, the Republicans call the CEOs job creators, but arguably they're job shippers, a lot of them, you know. I mean, in terms of the executive excess reports that you've done, how much does naming and shaming work in terms of sort of economic patriotism?
That's a tough question, Ian, because it's hard to show the impact. I mean, some of these guys are really beyond shaming and really think so highly of themselves that they think they're worth, 400 or 500 times It was stunning to me after the financial crisis when, you know, here were the guys who drove the economy off a cliff, and we were still hearing arguments about how, you know, they were opposed to the pay restrictions on the bailout companies, and they were rushing to return their bailout money so that they could boost up their CEO pay and get out of these, you know, onerous restrictions that had been put on pay. So it's really deeply, you know, embedded in the psyches of a lot of our corporate leaders that you have to pay that kind of money to get, you know, so-called top talent. Even if those top talented people destroy the economy, they still cling to that idea. So we've got a long ways to go, I think, in this country of changing the culture. But I will say I've been working on CEO pay issues for about 20 years, and I think that the level of you know, the romanticism of the American big company CEO that I felt like I was up against 15 and 20 years ago has subsided somewhat. People are much more skeptical about whether these guys are really getting paid for, you know, so-called performance. And I've just got to think that, it you know, as long as we can keep coming up with some concrete things that people can do about it, that's been the biggest problem. People are upset about it, but they don't feel like they can do anything about it. With this new rule, I do think we have some new ammunition to make change.
Well, but lately, corporate CEOs have been sitting on enormous profits. And rather than invest in R&D and new product lines, etc., a lot of them are buying back stock. And that drives up the price of the stock and makes them look good so that they can ask for more money. And that's a sort of self-perpetuating, self-serving cycle that's going on. In terms of the way that CEO pay is calibrated in this new SEC rule, since so much of their compensation comes from stock, do they include stocks as well as salaries?
They do. Yeah, I have seen some commentary out there today about how this could encourage more stock buybacks, and I have to really push back against that. I don't understand that reasoning, because the CEO pay total compensation figure that will be used in this ratio includes their stock options and their stock grants. So I don't see that as a problem. I will say it was interesting today listening to the debate in the SEC. One of the Republican commissioners was, you know, very doomsday-ish about where all of this was leading, and I had to actually enjoy some of these, you know, doomsday scenarios he was painting, because one of them was that, you know, oh my gosh, look where this might lead. It might lead to restrictions on stock buybacks. And I was like, well, that would be terrific. Other things he was warning about was that it could lead to more political spending disclosure for companies. And, you know, so in his mind, all of these would be horrible outcomes. In my mind, they would be fantastic outcomes of the momentum that we've got now behind this new disclosure rule. It was really quite a debate. I would encourage people to read some of the statements that were made today, just to see the extremely different points of views. The two Republicans who voted against the rule over and over again said that this was nothing but, you know, political demagoguery and bullying, and how horrible this was for America and the Constitution to have companies have to reveal how much they pay their workers. I don't think it'll resonate very far with ordinary Americans.
Well, the Republican Commissioner Daniel Gallagher said, to steal a line from Justice Scalia, this is pure applesauce. Well, one, quoting Justice Scalia, I'm not sure, is going to convince a lot of people. And two, what the hell does pure applesauce mean?
Understand that either. He was the one who was suggesting that this might be a violation of corporate free speech rights. He talked about how, you know, he thought this was the most useless of all Dodd-Frank mandates, a nakedly political rule that hijacks the SEC's disclosure regime to once again affect social change desired by ideologues and special interest groups. It was a really off the charts rhetoric that we heard coming out of these two Republicans, and it reflects just the extreme, you know, of vitriol in this debate. I think it was eye-opening for those of us who supported this disclosure rule to see how hard the pushback was, given the fact that it is just a disclosure rule. It's not forcing these companies to change what they pay their CEO. At the same time, I think it helped us understand the real potential here. They are freaked out about this new rule because they know it could lead to further reforms that will be much more effective in reining in CEO pay.
Well, Sarah Anderson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Anderson, who directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Sarah is lead author of 20 annual executive excess reports and serves on the investment subcommittees of the U.S. State Department's Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy. And she's the co-author of the Institute's 20th anniversary executive excess report, Bailed Out, Booted, and Busted. And her books include Field Guide to the Global Economy and Alternatives to Economic Globalization. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, Bernie Sanders, who is running for President of the United States.
You need it, that's for sure.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives, the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. He sits on the Veterans Committee and was tapped by Senate leadership to be the ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee. He also serves on the Environment and Public Works and Energy and Natural Resources, the Joint Economic and on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committees, and he is currently running for President of the United States as a Democrat. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And you've been in briefings on the P5+1 Iran deal today. It was pretty clear from Senator Corker's derisive remarks that Obama cannot count on any Republican votes. How does he stand in terms of how the Democratic caucus is holding the line in sustaining a presidential veto?
Well, I think there are Democrats who have legitimate concerns. This is an important agreement. People want to know that the inspection process is verifiable, that it's real. There's not a lot of trust for Iran. You know, and so I can't talk about what will happen, but everything being equal, I applaud what the president has tried to do, what Secretary Kerry has tried to do, because the alternatives are not particularly good. I think after coming out of a war in Iraq and a war in Afghanistan, certainly I think we should do everything that we possibly can to avoid a war with Iran with the goal of making sure they don't have a nuclear weapon. So I think a significant effort has been made. We'll see how it plays out here in the Congress.
And, of course, the president made a very impassioned speech today at American University echoing President Kennedy's 1963 speech, where Kennedy was basically arguing that we have to talk to our enemies and we cannot demonize the people of the Soviet Union, or in this case, the people of Iran, because they have hideous leadership. But in terms of opposition, particularly from Israel, where the president in his speech, by the way, said that Israel is alone the country that is opposing it, at least the leadership is, I've noticed that Prime Minister Netanyahu is getting some pushback from a number of top former heads of internal security and of the Mossad, as well as from Israel's chief of their Atomic Energy Commission.
I think the issue here, Ian, is, you know, it is very easy to say that the agreement is not perfect. It's not perfect. It's very easy to say that the agreement does not cover non-nuclear issues, that Iran will continue to be a sponsor of Hezbollah and continue to support terrorism. And that's true. But in the real world, you do the best that you can do. And in the real world now, the immediate concern is that without an agreement, it is possible that in several years' time, Iran could have a nuclear weapon. And this prevents that from happening. So it is, you know, it's easy to criticize that it doesn't do everything, doesn't bring peace to the Middle East, it doesn't reform Iran and make them into a peace-loving nation. But in the real world, I think this is a serious step forward.
And you have a piece in the Huffington Post, Senator Sanders, "The Fight for Voting Rights is Our Fight Today." Thursday, August the 6th, marks the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And clearly, the Supreme Court has not been helpful. When they struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, immediately a number of states had legislation ready to go. And we've seen what's happened in a number of states, and particularly right. in Texas and North Carolina. So where is the pushback going to come? Because it's such a fundamental right. I know you've suggested...
It is. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, this is so fundamental. And I worry very much, very honestly, about the future of American democracy. I wonder about, and I use the word advisedly, cowardly politicians who don't have enough confidence in their ideas resonating with their own constituents that they have to go overboard to try to prevent people from voting who disagree with them, who will vote against them. I think that is absolutely cowardly and absolutely un-American. And we're seeing it not only in those states that were originally included in the Voting Rights Act, but in other states as well, who did not have a history of discrimination, but now want to do everything that they can to prevent poor people from voting, older people, people of color from voting. And I think that's absolutely disgraceful. It really makes my blood boil because it is just an act of cowardly. You know, I'm a politician. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But you don't go out of your way to prevent people from voting. And the other aspects of where we are now, it's not only voting rights and voter suppression. We have a campaign finance system, which is absolutely, as a result of Citizens United, corrupt, and that is the right word to use. Huge amounts of money are coming from the wealthiest people in this country, who are hell-bent on electing politicians who will represent the wealthy and the powerful at the expense of working families. So we have, our voter turnout is very, very low. We have a system where it is much harder than in other countries to register to vote. I think that registration when you're 18 should be as automatic as possible. You're 18, guess what? You're registered to vote. You don't have to go through a long, complicated process. So there's a lot to be done to reinvigorate American democracy, get people to vote, and voter suppression, deal with campaign finance reform, huge issues that I intend to work very hard on.
And you, of course, offered a bill that would make voting day a public holiday.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that we have to do. The idea that we still have, you know, some states have moved to postcard voting and voting by mail and early voting. But on the other hand, most people still vote on election day. People work. It is certainly not incumbent. Someone, you know, is working. They got out of work at 6 o'clock in the evening. They can't make it to the polls. That's crazy. We need a day to celebrate democracy, where people can really appreciate what democracy is about. Think about who they want to vote for in the process, and I strongly support that as just one step of many that we need to reinvigorate American democracy.
And in your Huffington Post article, you point out that we're facing a two-pronged attack to our democracy from unlimited money pouring in to the right. political process paired with the systematic suppression of the vote. Now, in terms of the former, there was a big conclave last weekend down south of here at Dana Point in Orange County where the Koch brothers had their billionaire friends showed up for the long weekend. And one of the things I found particularly distressing and extraordinary about this event was that much of the mainstream press, with the exception of the New York Times, accepted the Koch brothers' ground rules that they couldn't report on who among the billionaires was in attendance. And it just seems to me that have we reached a point where our press doesn't feel the responsibility to let the American people know who is trying to buy their government?
Sadly, I think we have it. Let me take your point a step further, Ian. Let's be clear about the role the Koch brothers are now playing. They will spend in this campaign at least $900 million on the campaign itself. That's what they tell us. That does not include all of their think tanks and the other operations that they have, which they will define as quote-unquote non-political, but of course are right-wing. The Koch brothers will spend, if they spend $900 million, more money than either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. Now, you tell me, when the second wealthiest family in this country, an extreme right-wing family, spends close to $1 billion on an election, more than either of the major political parties, is that called democracy? I mean, would you really honestly, without getting, you know, to be terribly partisan, when you have one family spending more money than either of the two major political parties, what do you call it? And I would call it a step, a major step toward oligarchy. And here's, you talk about the media. Let me tell you this. The media will mention, of course, that the Koch brothers spend a lot of money. But with very, very few exceptions, they will not tell you what the Koch brothers stand for. Now, roughly speaking, people know what the Democrats stand for, and they know what the Republicans stand for. What do the Koch brothers stand for? Why are they spending $900 million? Just because they're, you know, hell of a good guys, and they like politics. What is their agenda? Well, I'll tell you what their agenda is. In 1980, David Koch ran for vice president of the United States on the Libertarian Party. And this is what he advocated at that point. He advocated not cutting Social Security, but the elimination of Social Security, the elimination of Medicare, the elimination of Medicaid, the elimination of public education, the elimination of the Environmental Protection Agency, the elimination of the U.S. Postal Service. In other words, this is an extreme, extreme right-wing family that believes that government should have virtually no role in our lives in protecting the American people with regard to retirement security, health care, education, environmental protection. How often have you read that in the media? In fact, have you seen any articles about that?
No, and indeed, I must say, Jeb Bush, Governor Bush, Republican candidate, is pretty much echoing that agenda, isn't he?
Exactly. That is, and it's not just Jeb Bush. The major political initiative and activity over the last 30 years has been the degree to which this extreme right-wing agenda, pushed by the Koch brothers and others, has now become an integral part of the Republican Party. The Republican Party and the Koch brothers, they think, by the way, Citizens United has not gone far enough. Citizens United only allows them to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in independent expenditures. They want to be able to personally employ members of the United States Senate and presidents by directly making contributions to that candidate. So in other words, they can go to a Jeb Bush and say, Jeb, here's a check for $1 billion. You are employed by me. They haven't achieved that yet, but that is their goal, and that is now the official position of the Republican Party. Direct contributions of unlimited sums of money to candidates.
And again, I'm speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives, the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. He sits on the Veterans Committee and was tapped by Senate leadership to be the ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee. He also serves on the Environment and Public Works, the Energy and Natural Resources, the Joint Economic, and on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committees. And he is currently running for President of the United States as a Democrat. Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your run for the presidency, because it really has.
And I can tell you I have not gotten that money from the Koch brothers. I can tell you on a good
Well, I was going to say, for a guy that's been going after the billionaires and not taking any money from anybody except grassroots citizens, you're doing extremely well. In a WMUR Granite State poll that just came out in New Hampshire, you are at a statistical tie with Mrs. Clinton. So in terms of the debates, I mean, obviously on the Republican side, there's a great deal of anticipation to Thursday's debate. When are we going to start seeing the sparks fly on the Democratic side? Because we need a robust debate here. What we're going to see on Thursday night is going to be, I think, almost like a reality show gone bad. You know.
Well, yes, I think that's right. I will tell you what they're going to tell you, so you don't have to watch it. I mean, you know, it's going to be more tax breaks for the rich. More cuts to every important program in America, denial of climate change, attack on women's rights, attack on gay rights. You know, that's about it. That's what these guys stand for. But what we need is, you know, debates are obviously one part of a campaign. But what we do need, and what is harder to do than you might think, is to really, because of the media and the media's reluctance to allow serious debate on serious issues, as opposed to treating politics as a soap opera or a baseball game. We need a major, major, major debate on the huge issues facing America. And to my mind, maybe the most significant is the collapse of the American middle class and the fact that almost all of the new wealth being created and new income being created is going to the top 1%. The fact that we have more income and wealth inequality than at any time since 1928. I mean, it's quite unbelievable and grotesque that the top 0.1% now owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. The fact, as we've just discussed, that we have a campaign finance system which is moving us to an oligarchy and allowing billionaires to buy elections. The fact that, according to the scientific community, climate change is threatening this entire globe. And if we don't get our act together, the planet we'll be leaving our kids and grandchildren may well be uninhabitable, or certainly less habitable than it is today. The fact that in America we have hundreds of thousands of kids who cannot afford to go to college, and others, millions of people with heavy, heavy student debt and high interest rates. I mean, these are the issues that impact the American people. These are the issues that have got to be discussed.
Well, as President of the United States, in terms of national security, which is always considered the primary responsibility of the president, it seems to me that when you look at what China is doing in terms of infrastructure and extraordinary pipelines and high-speed rails all the way from Beijing to the Indian Ocean in Pakistan and into Russia, it seems that infrastructure is a one part of the national security portfolio that we simply are not addressing. Eisenhower did it as a national security issue and built the great highway system in the United States.
You're right. As a national security issue. That is exactly right. But here's the point. I mean, where we are at right now, and everybody should understand this, and I don't mean to be overly partisan, but it's the simple truth. What the Republican Party wants to do, consistent with the Koch brothers' agenda, is to shrink government, shrink government, shrink government, and not spend money. I am the ranking member, Ian, of the Budget Committee, and that means leader of the Democratic opposition. What the Republican budget did is throw 27 million people off of health care, cut Pell Grants by $90 billion, made massive cuts in nutrition programs. Right now, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, we have over $3 trillion in infrastructure needs. Our infrastructure, roads, bridges, rail, wastewater plants, water systems, levees, dams, all of them are in very, very bad shape. And I have proposed a $1 trillion investment to rebuild parts of our infrastructure and create up to 13 million jobs. Republicans refuse to spend money. In fact, we passed a modest bill here in the Senate. They don't want to deal with it in the House. So, you know, what used to be 20 years ago, 15 years ago, nonpartisan, of course you invest in your infrastructure. Every idiot in the world knows that your infrastructure doesn't get better unless you invest in it. These guys are not doing that. And it is a very radical agenda, again, I think, fostered by the Koch brothers and other campaign contributors, in terms of climate change. Can you imagine? I mean, without, again, being political, there is no debate, a real debate in the scientific community about the reality or the causes of climate change or the kinds of damage that climate change is doing and will do. And yet a majority, I just brought forth a resolution, I'm on the Energy Committee, and I brought forth an amendment which I presented that says it is the sense of the committee that climate change is real, caused by human activity and already causing devastating problems. We have to address it. Do you know how many Republican votes I got on the committee? Zero, not one.
Well, just in closing, Senator Sanders, in your campaign, much of what you stand for basically are middle-class, working-class values. Of course, I saw you with slap down Bill O'Reilly on Fox, who was trying to brand you as a radical socialist. And I know from what you've said that if you get out into these red states, across this country, people will find out that you're basically on their side. There's nothing radical about your
program. There is nothing radical. Here's the point, and which drives me a little bit nuts about media in this country, corporate media. Every issue that I've talked about, creating jobs by rebuilding our infrastructure, raising the minimum wage, pay equity for women workers, making college, public colleges and universities tuition-free, dealing with this outrageous high level of student debt, all of those issues and many more are supported by the vast majority of the American people. Expanding Social Security, for example, supported by strong majority of the American people. The Republican agenda, on the other hand, tax breaks for billionaires, cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, I don't know, there are 10, 15, 20% of the people who support those things. And that's the reality. So your point is right. I think the issues that I am dealing with are kind of common sense, mainstream issues that the vast majority of working people in red states as well as blue states agree with. I was in Phoenix a couple of weeks ago. We had 11,000 people out in Phoenix. We will be going to Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina in the not-too-distant future. I think we're going to have support there as well.
Well, Senator Sanders, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives, the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. He sits on the Veterans Committee and was tapped by Senate leadership to be the ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee. He also serves on the Environment and Public Works and Energy and Natural Resources and the Joint Economic and on the Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committees. And he is currently running for President of the United States as a Democrat. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an analysis of why the Iranians went along with the P5 plus one deal and why Israel alone is the only country in the world opposed to it. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Abbas Milani, who's the Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project and, until 1986, taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he was also a member of the board of directors of the university's Center for International Relations. His latest book is The Shah. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abbas Milani.
Thank you for having me.
And the president today, in defending the P5 plus one deal with Iran, made some fairly forceful comments and basically said, let's not mince word. The choice we face is ultimately between diplomacy and some form of war. Those who say we can just walk away from this deal and maintain sanctions are selling a fantasy. What's your reaction to the president's challenge to his, not only in support of the deal, but he's also challenging the critics?
Well, I think in one fundamental sense, he's right. I mean, I don't think there is a viable alternative out there. Those who say that this is a bad deal and that there should be more sanctions and that Iran will come to the negotiating table for a better deal, I don't think are looking at the map. They're not looking at the number of foreign ministers from European countries that have already been to Iran, are eager to make deals. So strengthening the sanction regime, as it is already basically breaking down because everybody anticipates the regime to end, is, I think, a quixotic dream. So in one sense, it's right, there is no option on the table better than this one. And this one does go a long way in limiting Iran's nuclear program.
So do you think that the American business community can persuade some of the doubters, most of whom are on the Republican side, the absurdity of the idea that if the House and Senate reject this deal with enough votes to override a presidential veto, the Europeans, the Chinese, and the Russians are just going to do business with Iran, and we're going to be left in the dust?
Well, I think some of the companies clearly have been trying to lobbied the Congress for some time now, but I suspect that those efforts will increase. And I think that is the reality. If the United States walks away from this deal, two things will happen. If the deal eventually doesn't get ratified, that, in my view, is a very, very unlikely event, the United States will be blamed for it. And Iranian conservatives, who don't like the deal because they are making billions of dollars in the closed markets in Iran, they can then blame the U.S. and the Congress of the United States for the failure of the deal. Second, I think clearly the evidence is already there that everyone except the United States is out there trying to make a deal and trying to test the waters. I mean, it might be too soon because Iran is a turbulent place. It's one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The bureaucracy is corrupt. Revolutionary Guards control a disproportionate share of the economy. It's not going to be easy to walk in there and make a deal, but clearly they want to make the deal. And the longer the U.S. Delays this, or if they actually vote against it, I think the result is exactly as you suggested.
Well, in a way, President Obama, in his speech defending the P5+1 deal with Iran and sort of chastising his critics for not really having an alternative except war, and as Obama said, disparaging them, vague promises of toughness that's going to pressure Iran into submission are either ignorant of Iranian society, or they're not being straight with the American people. But in terms of the more lofty parts of the speech, many are saying that he borrowed from President Kennedy's speech during the Cold War, where Kennedy argued that no government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. And Obama made the case in this speech today that just because Iranian hardliners chant death to America does not mean that that's what all Iranians believe. Do you think that's going to resonate with the American people?
I hope it does, because I think it is, to me, incontrovertible truth. I've written several pieces about this long before this issue arose. Anybody who has traveled to Iran, from journalists to chefs to visitors, can confirm this. The Iranian society is not the Iranian regime. This septuagenarian male society that chants death to America, death to Israel, is not the entirety of Iran. Iran is a different society as well. Iran has 60-odd% of its graduates being women. Iran is a disproportionately large, young society, disproportionately favorable to the United States and to the West. Just today, there was a quote in one of the Iranian papers published by the Iranian the spokesperson for the Rouhani government that in the poll they have done, 94%, I think, above 90% of the Iranian people want this deal to go through. So the hardliners are really 6-7% of the Iranian people, and I think that is actually absolutely right. There is an underground, a very, very pervasive underground of dissident culture, dissident music, dissident theater, raves in Tehran and major capitals, major cities where young people get together and engage in kinds of activities that are absolutely at odds with the image of this dour puritanical regime that the regime wants the world to imagine and believe in.
So in terms of the underground society that you just mentioned, particularly amongst the young, I believe the educated and particularly the business community are also deeply anxious to get back into the world community, and that they smart against the isolation that the country has endured. And how would you compare that, say, that policy of obviously the sanctions did force the hardliners to come to the table? I recall that Ayatollah Khomeini said in ending the Iran-Iraq war that he had to drink poison. What's your sense to why they came? Why did they make the deal, the hardliners?
I think you're, at least in my judgment, completely right. The reason they came, particularly Khomeini and some of the conservative clerics, because again, if you remember, the old president Rouhani and some of his entourage had been wanting to make a deal. It was Khamenei who had said, no deal with the United States. They're the great Satan. This is a red line. He changed because the economy began to really go south. Iran has had double-digit unemployment, double-digit inflation concurrently for virtually the last 35 years, with the exception of one. The ability for them to sell oil was diminished considerably, and 80% of government expenditure is based on oil. Their ability to do financing was limited, curtailed seriously after Iran was thrown off the off SWIFT. So contrary to what many in the regime and some of the regime advocates here say, what changed is the sanctions began to hurt. And Iranian society was at a very, very, I think, potentially perilous moment. The regime realized that people are angry, the economy is hurting, people are hurting. And every indication we've had since there was the possibility of the deal is that if the atmosphere opens up, more and more people inside Iran will begin to ask serious questions about why the country was brought to the precipice of collapse.
Well, but one of the things that you have to ask yourself is, why did Russia go along with the deal if indeed it will mean that very shortly, or at least early next year, Iranian oil will come on the market, and we already have a glut on the market and low prices because the Saudis are dumping oil, and that's going to hurt Russia. My conclusion would be that Russia made a deal against its own interests because they simply don't want Iran to get a nuclear bomb. Neither does China, neither does Germany, neither does France, neither does Britain, and neither does the U.S. Isn't that the logic?
Absolutely. I mean, Russia was in a double bind. On the one hand, they were making like gangbusters from Iran's isolation and from high oil prices as a result of tensions in the region. Now the oil prices have fallen. As you say, Saudis are dumping oil to make sure that no more fracking ideas emerge in the West. But at the same time, Russia couldn't seem to be the only person that is helping Iran develop a bomb in its neighborhood. They have Chechnya to worry about. They have a lot of Muslim neighboring states to worry about. They have an arms race in the region to worry about. They have their effort. Clearly, Russia is now very much trying to have a rapprochement with the Arab states, to have a rapprochement with Saudi Arabia, with GCC. The GCC is having a meeting, Mr. Kerry went, Lavrov was there too. So they were caught in a difficult position. And I think going along with the deal, while having clearly some difficulty for them financially, was no way that they could stand out as the sole country that is supporting the Islamic Republic.
Well, just in the last few minutes, I wanted to talk about the only country in the world that really is against this deal is Israel, and its leader, Prime Minister Netanyahu, is adamantly against this deal. And even his own former head of the Mossad, the intelligence service there, is basically criticizing Netanyahu and saying, you know, you've got to look at the deal. It actually could end up being really good for Israel. And, you know, so he's getting some pushback within his own country, but clearly he has a lot of influence with the Republicans. And he, as you know, he came and gave a speech on Capitol Hill basically trashing the president of the United States, which is pretty unprecedented. So my understanding is that, first of all, we know that the idea that the Iranian hardliners, and they've said it, obviously, that they want to wipe Israel off the map, or some version of that, Ahmadinejad said, that's absurd. The country that it can actually wipe Iran off the map is Israel. It's not the other way around. But my sense is that what's probably going on, really, with Israel is that they don't like the idea that the United States will now have a choice in the region of who they get to deal with, you know, because after all, going to back to the days of the Shah, much of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East was also rested with Iran as well as Israel. And so what's your sense of why Netanyahu is so adamantly against this deal?
Well, first of all, on the one hand, he is against this deal because he has essentially based much of his political career in the last few two decades almost on fighting the Iran nuclear program. And as many in Israel say, as for example, I was reading an editorial in Haaretz that were saying that this has been his sort of lifetime cause, and now that it seems to be a lost cause, he is not very happy. Second, having said that, I think when you have a regime like Iran and some of its leaders constantly take a kind of a sinister pleasure in suggesting that they will clear Israel off the map so that people don't then accuse us or accuse me of not having correctly translated what Ahmadinejad and what Khamenei and what Jannati and several other clerics have said in the last few days alone. I mean, one of the top clerics recently said we should make it incumbent on all government officials to consistently repeat that clearing the map of Israel is part of our goal. When you make these kinds of allegations and when you constantly threaten that we have given 100,000 missiles to Hezbollah in Lebanon that can hit anywhere in Israel, then that kind of rhetoric coming from Mr. Netanyahu finds a better base of support both inside Israel and outside. But I fully agree with you that I think both inside Israel and in the United States, I mean, you have a divided Jewish community in the United States. J Street is clearly for this deal, as are many prominent American Jewish leaders and intellectuals and scholars, and many, many prominent Jewish intellectuals, and AIPAC foremost amongst them in terms of Jewish organizations, are adamantly opposed to it. And, but again, my surprise is that Israel is willing to be, as I think Obama correctly said, the only country that is fighting this deal. Europeans are not. The French that stood with Israel every step of the negotiations and were making some of the most difficult demands on Israel, they were the first country that almost ran to Iran to try to make a deal. So while I clearly understand that Israel has a right to feel uncomfortable with these kinds of threats, but I also agree with you that you know, Israel has submarines that are armed with nuclear warheads, apparently, not far off the Iranian coast. They have more than 200 bombs. And as, again, one of the past Mossad leaders, I think, said recently, said to say that Iran can existentially threaten Israel is to undervalue the power that Israel has and what has Israel been able to do over the last 60 years since its creation in creating a viable state.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Abbas Milani.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Abbas Milani, who's the Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.